From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for Father's Day weekend 2022. The Brewers are still on the road, but starting Monday, the St. Louis Cardinals come to town for a four-game series. And Monday is also a ride your bike to work day or to the ballpark. At these gas prices, that's a great idea. Okay, talk dirty to me now. The town of Malmo, Sweden is installing 18 talking garbage cans that dish out sexy messages after being fed trash. Sounds like guys I know. The point is for Swedish litter bugs to use the trash cans more frequently. The cans used to say polite things like, "Thank you for keeping Sweden clean," but that wasn't very effective. So they tried a new approach. For example, "Oh baby, right there. Come back soon and let's do that again." Sounds like the can is getting more action than I am. Here are a couple of stories that are the same story. The author of the successful book, How to Murder Your Husband, was found guilty of murdering her husband. And a man who raps about robbing ATMs got arrested for robbing an ATM. I wonder if they know each other. A Raleigh, North Carolina exterminator will pay a family $2,000 for a chance to release 100 cockroaches in their house. The company says the 30-day elimination study will be safe for family members and pets. In today's market, 100 cockroaches, no problem. They could probably still sell that house for more than they're asking. And finally, a QAnon cult leader who predicted 6 months ago that President Kennedy would make an appearance at one of their wacky rallies. Of course, he didn't. Well, his cult nut is at it again. He said his math was wrong and JFK will definitely make an appearance this weekend in Dallas. What are the odds JFK stiffs this guy again? On the podcast today, we have, in English, not Swedish, we have Dave Sandstrom, Chris Evers, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tidding.
Well, thanks, Max. A tough week overall for markets. The NASDAQ down 4.8% this week, closing the bell at 10,798. The S&P down 5.8%, closing at 36.74, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 4.8%, closing at 29.885. For the year, the Dow now down 16.9%, the S&P down 22.3%, and the NASDAQ down 30.7%. On the week, the benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury yield moved higher, closing the week at 3.24% after beginning at 3.16%. Maybe a quick look at performance there. But, Chris, I think a bigger story this week than the numbers is certainly what the Fed has decided to do with the overnight rate, the first three-quarter point move in 28 years. Going back to 1994, the last time we really had this type of bond market, the type we've been in. And certainly I think, you know, as you look at the market's response to what's been happening with inflation, expectations for maybe what the economic impact of what the Fed is doing, a lot to digest with the Fed this week.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, the Fed, I think, has admitted that maybe they were initially wrong on their diagnosis of inflation, and they've got to play a little catch-up now. And you saw that with the 75 basis point move. They had all but telegraphed it was going to be 50 basis points. Again, that's 0.5% and 0.75%. In terms of what they would increase the overnight rate by. So they got to play a little catch up of pushing rates higher. The markets digested that this week. You saw the 10-year Treasury move much higher throughout the week, topping out at about 3.48. So clearly we're seeing a tightening of financial conditions from the Fed, and they're moving forward with a more aggressive path than what they had originally signaled because of the data. It's not really coming down the way that they would have hoped.
And Dave, I think the challenge, of course, is that the Fed is chasing this runaway train of inflation. And, you know, as we're fond of talking about, you don't always know what the impact of what the Fed is doing. You don't really know that impact until months down the road. And so, you know, I think they're operating in this environment in which, you know, they're kind of just doing what they can do now and hoping that the data 3 or 4 months from now reflects the change. You know, I think the big concern with that, obviously, is that they do too much. They put the economy into, a recession is the big risk, obviously, and something that's been talked about quite a bit. But, you know, I think if you look at, you know, kind of what has been happening right now, the 10-year, Chris, as you mentioned, you look at, you know, the 7-year, the 5-year treasury, yeah, they've moved a little bit higher, but not higher as quick as some of the other rates. And so I think as we look at the markets more broadly, painting a picture of the fact that inflation may be a problem for a little while longer, but the long-term forecast maybe hasn't changed all that much.
Kyle, you're right on the money with the difficulties the Fed's facing as they try to find that sweet spot as they move forward here. And to your point, they won't really know the results of these moves for quite some time. And I think ultimately it's the pace is really secondary to where they end up. I think that's going to be the key is, you know, where does this end? And really, until inflation numbers start to reverse course, the Fed is going to keep raising interest rates, right? That's, I mean, part of their strategy here is as a dual mandate to provide the country with stable pricing. It's to beat down inflation. And I think they're going to be committed to that until they start to see some progress in those numbers coming down.
Oh, and Joel, a good time to bring you in. You know, the Fed's dual mandate, number one is price stability, but number two is, employment level, right? The understanding that we want to put as many people to work as we can in this country. The challenge we've had is that we can put as many people to work as we want. We just don't have enough people. And so, we got some data this week on the unemployment numbers. Certainly, you know, I think pointing to maybe a little softening there, but, in terms of the rate of unemployment or the number of people filing for unemployment, but, you know, more of the same probably, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we look at the weekly numbers on initial applications for unemployment, and those reached, if we look at the four-week moving average, that reached a record low in early April. And since then, we've been up 9 out of 10 weeks. The number of filings using that measure are up 25%, but they're still 41% below the 55-year average for that. So, you know, kind of big picture, we're in a healthy labor market. If you look at it more narrowly, it might be getting worse. You know, those initial claims are a sign of early unemployment. So it might be getting a little tougher.
And I think we need to be clear that, you know, the Fed has always said, as long as employment isn't a problem, we have cover to raise rates to combat inflation. And so I think more good news from the labor market that the Fed can keep doing what they need to do. The challenge is going to be, should those numbers start to change, what does that mean longer term for what the Fed's options are? And does the Fed have to go back the other direction? You know, I think if recession is really the concern that so many people are talking about, and I think it's a reasonable concern, a survey this week coming from the conference board, 60% of CEOs surveyed said that they see a recession in the next 12 to 18 months. Well, that may change their outlook a little bit on hiring. And of course, if you don't have a job and if you can't find a job, that may change your ability to spend a little bit. And so I think all of this kind of feeds into the inflation problem that we're dealing with.
And what that tight labor market does, though, is that it gives those CEOs pause if they're thinking of not hiring. It gives them pause at least of not letting people go, because in a tight labor force, if they let people go, they might not be able to get anybody back if their businesses, you know, start needing people again.
Yeah, and so again, I think all of this points to a market that, while we're still trying to digest what the Fed has done this week, while we're still trying to get a handle on inflation, you know, the vast majority of the economic indicators are pointing to an economy that is mostly healthy.
Yeah, and we're starting to see things slow down a little bit, which, you know, I guess the Fed would hope for, right? I mean, and how much of it is because of the higher interest rates? Who knows how much, you know, how far this is going? Who knows? But your point is that we're in a relatively healthy position. So, you know, concerns about recession kind of seem a way off. I mean that a recession would be a way off, just because. So we had figures on housing this week, on housing starts and building permits. Both of those softened a little bit, but they're both at or near where we were before the pandemic. We're both of those are, you know, near where we were, kind of midway between the housing boom in 2006 and when it collapsed by 2009. So it's still, you know, a relatively high point. We had numbers today from the Fed on industrial output, and that's indexed to inflation, actually, and that's never been higher. But it slowed down. It's, you know, it was up 5 months in a row, and this was the smallest gain in those 5 months. And in manufacturing, which is important, there was actually a decline for the first time in 5 months. And then the other number, and Chris, I want you to talk a little bit more about that, is retail sales. I mean, we know that consumers really drive our economy, and retail sales in May went down for the first time in 5 months. And some of the things that actually went up, and it was a broad decline, so a lot of different retailers saw people spending less money. And a couple of exceptions were gas stations and grocery stores, and one of the reasons for that is the prices are higher, so people are spending more there, not necessarily buying more, but they're spending more because they're getting higher prices.
Yeah, if I could just paint a picture, really, of what this most recent report showed, it, you know, it's a consumer that has a certain amount of money on their budget, and the money that's being allocated to gasoline and food costs keeps going up, right, because of this inflation data. So what happens is consumers pulling back on other areas of spending. You know, and if we tie this to the Fed and their desire to essentially slow economic growth, slow consumer spending to try to get inflation under control, well, if we think about the mechanism in which higher interest rates actually impacts that, okay, what do you buy using debt? You buy a house. Okay, we've seen a slowdown in housing in terms of purchases. Cars, well, in this most recent retail report, I think the worst portion of the report was used car sales. So you're seeing the two areas that are most clearly impacted by a higher interest rate actually impacting that data. Whether you go and buy, you know, 2 gallons of milk or 1 gallon of milk really isn't impacted by what the level of the overnight rate is by the Fed. But things, you know, like housing and cars are. So I think when you look through that retail sales report and you see car sales coming down, you can draw a straight line to what the Fed is doing. And that kind of all makes sense to me.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just so interesting to look at some of the nuances in some of this data and really understand that, you know, there's a lot more going on than just gas prices are higher, right? That there's all these underlying issues with the labor market. There's all these underlying issues with, you know, what the Fed is doing that might, you know, cause demand to degrade a little bit in, you know, major purchase areas. And, you know, all of these are, they take time to digest. But I think, you know, there's two numbers that I want to keep in mind here. And Dave, maybe you can weigh in on these. Number one is that since the pre-COVID peak for the S&P 500, the S&P is up 8.5%. So despite the fact that we're down in bear market territory now, you're still positive relative to the peak prior to COVID. The other number, the reverse of that may be that since the start of this year, really since the peak this year, you're down almost 23.5% in the S&P. And so, you know, I think they paint a very different picture of how well things really have gone the past few years, given how badly they could have gone, but also how quickly things have changed.
And, you know, Kyle, we entered in the bear market beginning of this week, and I know this has been a long grind for investors. And this time around, in this particular bear market, it isn't so much the depths, I don't think, of the declines. It's the pace that it's taken to get here. It's been a grueling march. There's no question about it. I mean, you think back to during the pandemic, S&P was down in the mid-30% range, significantly lower than it is now at that point. But 2 months later, we were out of it. So it was a quick sigh of relief, and it didn't weigh on investors. Didn't have the opportunity to weigh on investors, of course, because you didn't have the time frame. So I think it's important to just point out some of the things that come with bear markets. And historically speaking, the S&P after a bear market has done quite well. If you go back to World War II, the next 12 months, the day following a bear market, the S&P has averaged about 23%. So, you know, not to say that that's a guarantee or to book it this afternoon, but, you know, I think it's a good indicator that when you get to bear market territory, you're usually looking at a lot of the bad stuff is behind you.
And I want to be clear that some of the best days following bear markets tend to happen early on. And so missing out on those best days really can hurt you long term, right? This idea that, well, things look bad right now, so we're going to sell out and we'll buy back in when things look a little better. Well, you know, your example of, you know, the COVID pandemic, how quickly the market turned back around. I know I wasn't feeling better about where we were. And certainly I think, you know, if you looked at, you know, the numbers for COVID illness, if you looked at anything else that was going on in the economy, we certainly hadn't recovered by the time the market started turning around. So plenty to point out there. The other thing worth mentioning is that stocks all of a sudden look fairly attractive. The forward PE on the S&P 500 is now 15.5. That's an earnings yield of, you know, north of 6.4%. And so, you know, when you look at what's a dollar invested in the stock market get me versus a dollar invested in a bond market that admittedly has far higher yields, you know, all of a sudden stocks look pretty attractive again, with the caveat that bonds may look even more attractive relative to where they've been. And so that doesn't mean things don't get cheaper from here. In fact, I think there's a lot of noise out there still with what the Fed is doing and with some of the other issues that we're dealing with. But of course, all of that is to say that if you can get something at a deal, you don't necessarily care that it becomes a better deal. You care that you got a good price on it. And I think that may be where we are right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when there is a sell-off in the market, a lot of times it starts based on fundamentals, right? Prices were a little ahead of themselves and interest rates were going up. Completely makes sense. But it usually transfers from fundamentals to capitulation or people just, you know, momentum causing people to sell. Really, it's probably on the same way on the way up too, right? People buy stocks because the fundamental reason behind it is strong. And eventually near the end of the cycle, people are buying stocks because they've made money, you know, not because, hey, I'm buying a company that's generating good cash flow for what I'm paying. No, somebody's buying stocks because look at what they've done the last 10 years. You know, it's the same thought process is used on the way down, right? People start selling things because look what we've gone through for the last, you know, 6 months. Why wouldn't I sell stocks? Well, you know, if the fundamentals then become more attractive at that point, and then eventually the pendulum swings back the other way. So as long-term investors, we're always kind of looking for that pendulum swing.
Yeah, and buy when everybody's selling and sell when everybody's buying, right? Those are when the opportunities tend to exist. And so I think, you know, as we look at the heels of a pretty rough week, obviously, as we look at some potential pain still ahead with, you know, conversations around the Fed and everything else that's going on, just challenge investors to really think a little bit longer term about, you know, what the opportunity set really is right now. Well, thanks for listening. We enjoy doing the program. We will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.